Lecture 7, Paradise Regained, The Space Trilogy, Part 1.
Last time in Lecture 6, we saw how Lewis the Scholar fought to rehabilitate both the beauty and truth of the medieval model of the universe and of the power and value of such genres as science fiction and fantasy. In the 5 lectures that follow, we shall see how Lewis, in his Space Trilogy and in his 7 Chronicles of Narnia, enacted and embodied this rehabilitation in his fiction. In this lecture, we shall consider how, in Out of the Silent Planet and Perelandra, Lewis takes us on a journey through a living universe to 2 planets that still exist in an Edenic state. We shall see, too, how he uses these journeys to critique modern man's arrogant lust for immortality. Out of the Silent Planet is the first installment in 3 or a trilogy of science fiction novels. And in this novel, we learn how a philologist or a studier of language named Ransom is kidnapped by 2 evil men, Divine and Weston, and is carried by spaceship to the planet Mars. Now, upon landing on Mars, Ransom actually escapes from his abductors, Divine and Weston, and seeks refuge with an intelligent, beaver-like race of warriors known as the Hross. And, being a philologist, he quickly learns their language, and he learns that Mars, or Malacandra, as they call it, actually houses 3 rational creatures, or what they call Hna. And those 3 creatures are the Hross. There's also a second group known as the Sorns, and they are tall and thin, and they are the abstract thinkers. They are the scientists and the mathematicians. Finally, a third race is called the Fitheltrigi, and they look like frogs, and they are sort of the blue-collar craftsmen of Malacandra. Now, although these 3 races are very different, they all live together in utopic harmony and equality, a sort of Plato's Republic. However, all of them obey the Oyarsa. And the Oyarsa is an angelic guardian spirit who not only rules over Mars, but also rules over the lesser angels that are known as Eldila. Hitting you with a little bit of terminology here. Now, after a while, Divine and Weston show up on the scene. They find Ransom, and they actually kill several of the Hross, rather violently. Well, Ransom is forced to flee to safety, and he goes up to the mountains of Malacandra, where he meets a Sorn. And on the back of the Sorn, he's carried to the garden where the Oyarsa lives. And we're finally going to find out what's going on. The Oyarsa explains to Ransom that he, the Oyarsa, had asked Divine and Weston to bring another human being so he could talk to them. But Divine and Weston, being evil-minded, thought the Oyarsa wanted a human sacrifice. But all he wanted to do was talk to Ransom. Now, some of you are wondering, if he's an Oyarsa, why does he need to talk to anybody? He should know everything. But we discover that from the point of view of Mars, Earth is the silent planet, or Tholkandra in their language. Now, why is Earth Tholkandra, or the silent planet? Well, we learn many ages ago, the Oyarsa of Earth, it turns out that all the planets have an Oyarsa, or a guardian spirit, the Oyarsa of Earth had rebelled against Mal-El-Dil, which is their name for the creator. And not only did this earthly or terrestrial Oyarsa rebel, he seized control of the Earth and then tried to corrupt Malacandra and the other planets. Well, Mal-El-Dil would not have this. And so Mal-El-Dil declared the Earth enemy-occupied territory and placed a cosmic quarantine on it. Therefore, we are Tholkandra. We move ahead in the plot. In the finale, Divine and Weston appear on the scene again. They find the Oyarsa, and they explain that it is their intention to seize and colonize Mars as a way to perpetuate and preserve the human race. And they believe this right is due them because they, the Earthlings, have an advanced civilization. Well, the Oyarsa quickly neutralizes their threat and orders them to go home. And Ransom decides that he will go home as well. After an arduous, near-fatal journey, the three men return to Earth. And as soon as they get out of the spaceship disintegrates, thus preventing any further trips to Mars. Well, that's the plot in a nutshell. Let us now talk about the characters. Our hero, of course, is Ransom. And Ransom is an interesting combination of Tolkien, who was himself very much a philologist, and C.S. Lewis himself. Kind of you put the two together, you get Ransom. And at the beginning of the novel, Ransom is a modern, scientific-minded, myth-exploding skeptic. In other words, he's just like C.S. Lewis the atheist before he went to Oxford and even in his early Oxford years. However, during the course of the tale, Ransom's eyes, like those of the young Lewis, are slowly opened to greater spiritual reality. So it's a kind of a spiritual journey for Ransom. Ransom's education, if you want to call it that, actually begins on his journey to Mars. Like most moderns, Ransom expects space or outer space to be dead, cold, and dark. But he's shocked that when he looks out the window as they're racing through outer space, do you know what he sees? Not dead and coldness. He sees a warm, dazzling field throbbing with life. And Lewis talks about this in The Discarded Image, his book about the medieval model, that medievals believed that the universe was filled with life, what they called plenitude. It was filled with life. And believe me, once you read the novel Out of the Silent Planet, you will never forget that image of space as warm and throbbing. In response or against that, our Earth is a dead, cold place. Space is full of life. Well, once on Mars, Ransom's chronological snobbery, you remember that word, is shattered even more as he encounters a medieval, even Homeric type of society whose virtues surpass our own. Most of the time he spends with the cross, and he realizes these people have a virtue that we human beings lack. Indeed, he discovers that the innocent cross can only conceive of evil as being bent. They're so good and so perfect in a way, they don't even know what evil is. And I bet many of you have read Gulliver's Travels, Part 4. That's when he stays with a utopic race of horses known as the Houyhnhnm. And the Houyhnhnmm don't even know what a lie is. So the only way they can understand it is to say, a lie is saying the thing that is not. Well, in here, they don't have a word for evil, so they call it being bent. Now, at first, back to the chronological snobbery, Ransom, who is again entrenched in a biased, modernist view of politics and religion, can only understand the relationship between the three Malachandrian races in terms of force. They really can't get along. There must be some kind of power politics, realpolitik, underneath that I'm not seeing. Also, he can only conceive of the Oyarsa as a cold, arbitrary deity. He can't really be a patriarch or father. He must be a cold, you know, terrible, uncaring force. However, his prejudices are soon shattered. The nobility of the cross allows him to believe that there's really equality and harmony here. And when he meets the Oyarsa and sees how real and loving he is, it shatters his religious prejudices. Indeed, even better, as all of these things happen to Ransom, he begins to nurture within himself the medieval chivalric virtues of courage and loyalty. Or to put it in the language of Lecture 3, Ransom gains a chest. He gains that virtuous chest that we talked about in relationship to the Tao. Well, that's what happens to Ransom. No such change occurs to Divine and Weston. Divine and Weston, surrounded by the beauty and wonder of Mars, are unable to see anything but greed, lust, and conquest. They do not have eyes to see, to quote that biblical phrase. Indeed, Divine and Weston are never able to view the Malachandrians as anything but ignorant savages. And as far as they're concerned, the fact that the Malachandrians are not advanced technologically obviously proves they're barbarians. Talk about chronological snobbery. Now, of the two, Divine and Weston, Divine is clearly the less dangerous of the villains. Why? Because Lewis tells us Divine's evil is spurred on merely by avarice. We learn that gold is plentiful on Mars, and all Divine cares about is bringing back the gold, like going to El Dorado and bringing back the gold. Another way to put it, the broken, mercenary Divine has sunk below humanity to become an animal, and in so doing has become a beast. In a way, he has ceased to be human. He's lower than human. Now, that's bad. But Weston is worse, because Weston is not broken. Weston is bent. Weston is evil. Weston, in the novel, has sought to rise above humanity to become an angel, and in so doing has become a demon. Divine has basically become a beast, and he's only as bad as a beast is. But Weston tries to be an angel, and in so doing becomes a demon. Remember lecture two again. When you try to make a human thing into an angel, it becomes a demon. You see, Weston's evil is more dangerous because what he has done is taken one ideal, one virtue, and for him, that is the survival and evolution of the species. And that virtue has become everything for Weston. Now, that is a virtue, and when you view it within the context of the Tao, the moral code, that is a true virtue. But when you do as Weston has done, when you take that virtue and you twist it out of its context and you enshrine it as an inexorable command to be obeyed and worshipped, what happens? It becomes an idol. And that's what Weston has done. Weston is, we could call him a totalitarian. He has taken one virtue and has made it a god. And he thinks he can do anything in the name of that virtue. See how Lewis is taking ideas we talked about in the first half of this lecture series and is enshrining or embodying them in his fiction. Thus, to be more specific, in the name of humanity and the propagation of the race, Weston is quite prepared to kill any human being who gets in his way. He's a humanitarian who loves humanity but hates human beings. And he's willing to do anything. Another way to put it, to be the Prometheus who brings us knowledge, Weston is ready to become the Satan who destroys our peace. Now, I would argue that Weston has three forerunners. One of them is good old Thrasymachus, back to Plato's Republic. Might makes right. He's very much a child of Thrasymachus. But he's also a child of Machiavelli. Remember, the ends justify the means. Finally, he is a child of Nietzsche. And think of what Nietzsche did. Nietzsche sought human perfection not in religion, but in the will to power. And Weston definitely has a will to power. But there's a little bit more to this. There is a spiritual side to Weston. But you see, Weston's spiritual faith does not lie in a personal god, or even in a band of heroes, but in that vital force, or elan vital, that philosophers like Henri Bergson and artists like George Bernard Shaw and H.G. Wells and Nikos Kazantzakis, that's the Greek author of the Zorba the Greek and The Last Temptation of Christ and many other novels. What is this idea of elan vital or vital force or vital energy? Well, the belief, and again, Henri Bergson is the main proponent of this, is that there is spirituality in the universe, but rather than there being a personal god, a Yahweh or something like that, what he believed is that there is this energy, this force, and this force is not really personal, but this force is evolving over the centuries. And this force is evolving partly through us, through human beings. And our job is to be a vehicle for the final evolution and perfection of that elan vital or that vital force. And in a way, that's what Weston believes in. He believes humanity has to keep evolving and evolving and moving out to other planets till it evolves into something greater. Now, towards the end of the novel, there is a brilliant scene that is pure Lewis. You see, Weston wants to explain his philosophy to the Oyarsa, but Weston doesn't know the language of the Oyarsa. And so what Lewis does is Weston explains his philosophy in English, and then Ransom translates it into the language of the Oyarsa. And do you know what happens when he does that? What happens is that all of Weston's, quote, noble ideals are exposed for the shallow claptrap they are. When you take all those words and put them in English, then we suddenly realize the horror. When you stop talking about ethnic cleansing and you start talking about massacring people, then the mask is off. Well, that's what Lewis is doing. George Orwell does similar things in a lot of his works. But although it's claptrap, it is dangerous claptrap. You see, the low capitalism of divine is tame compared to the finely totalitarian dream of Weston, who sees all humanity as a sort of cosmic compost and all life as raw material for pure scientific vivisection. We are just so much compost to Weston. Well, as you can see, Weston's philosophy is not only anti-life, it's finally anti-humanistic. And indeed, that anti-humanistic, anti-life philosophy is finally that of Satan or the devil. And when I say that, and when Lewis says it in his novel, he doesn't mean that figuratively. He means it literally. Did you all figure out what's going on here? Have you figured out who the terrestrial Oyarsa is who rebelled against Mal-el-Dil? He is none other than Satan. For Lewis, our world really is enemy-occupied territory. And we humans who dwell on the earth are marred by the same pride and disobedience that motivated Satan to rebel. So Lewis is taking the Christian story and putting it sort of in allegorical or at least cosmological terms. Now, we try to figure out what the problem is with human beings. And Ransom learns the problem with human beings is not so much that we lack a good Oyarsa. You know what the problem is? Each one of us wants to be our own Oyarsa. We rebel and want to be our own. Now, in a wonderful scene, we learn that the Oyarsa of Mars, or Malakandra, has heard rumors of Mal-el-Dil's struggles with the Bent One. That is Satan. But he doesn't know anything about it because of Fulcondra, the silent planet. But he tells Ransom that he longs to look into those things. And it's a wonderful reference to the Bible where it says even the angels long to look into the Christian story. And at the end of the novel, Ransom whispers something in the Oyarsa's ear, and the Oyarsa wonders at it. And it's pretty clear he's telling him the story about Christ, the whole gospel, if you will. It's a wonderful, wonderful moment. But that's not all. The novel ends on a very interesting note that you're not expecting. It ends with apocalyptic intimations of spiritual warfare to come. This is only the beginning. A greater spiritual warfare is coming to the earth that will involve all of the planets. But unfortunately, Lewis tells us, and it's in his own voice now, our post-enlightenment books tell us nothing of such spiritual warfare, nor of such metaphysical realities. We have no defenses against this because we don't know anything about it. So we have to turn back to the medievals, because they're the ones that understood angelology and spiritual warfare and whatnot. Do you get what's happening here? It turns out that knowledge of the medieval model will not only make us into better students, scholars, and thinkers, it just may save our lives. Let us move on now to the second novel of the space trilogy, and that is called Perelandra, or the outer space name for Venus. Our hero, or protagonist, is once again Ransom, and this time Ransom is carried to Venus, not by spaceship, but by the Eldila. The angels actually carry Ransom to Venus. And when he arrives, he encounters a pre-fallen world replete with an Adam and Eve, and Ransom engages in a titanic struggle to prevent the demon-possessed Weston from tempting the innocent queen of Venus. That's the plot, and we're going to spend a lot of time on it. Now, in this lecture, we shall focus only on the Edenic state of Venus and its queen. Then in the next lecture, we shall explore the Miltonic dimensions of Ransom's struggle with evil, because Paralandra is a replay of Genesis 3, the fall of man. But let's start by just looking at the Edenic state of Venus in this lecture. I would argue, and many would agree, that Lewis marshals his finest prose to conjure up the landscape of Venus. We learn that much of Venus is covered by ocean, and skimming the surface of that pristine water are floating islands that move and fluctuate and dance with the waves. And believe me, if you read Paralandra, you will never forget those floating islands. It's the most beautiful image you can imagine as they float gracefully over the waves. Well, during the novel, Ransom rides and sleeps on those floating islands, and their gentle undulations fill him with a pleasure he has never known. A pleasure neither sexual nor asexual, but transsexual. In other words, they are pleasures that our earthly bodies are too weak to enjoy. I remind you of something I've said before. Our emotions are not too strong for heaven, but they are too weak. And so here, let's put it this way. The excessive pleasure of Venus, its exuberance and prodigality overwhelms Ransom's senses. It's a sensory overload. But you know what the wonderful thing is? All of that sensual pleasure comes to Ransom without any guilt. This is an Edenic pre-fallen world, and so the sensual pleasures come to us without any guilt. Let me give you some examples of that pleasure. Ransom sucks the juice out of a gourd, and the intensity of the taste satisfies both hunger and thirst. He bursts the pod of a bubble tree and is showered by an ice-cold stream that refreshes his body, fills his nostrils with a sharp, shrill, exquisite scent, and so cleanses his eyes as to make the colors around him seem richer. And again, all of this comes free from guilt. Now, at first, Ransom desires to take in a second time the sweetness of the gourd and the tree. He wants to do it again, if you will. But both times he stops himself, not out of guilt, but out of a refusal to spoil the joy and freshness of the pleasure by seeking what Lewis calls an unnecessary encore. In other words, he won't do it again and again and again. For Lewis, that is part of the fallen human race, our desire to hold on to a pleasure and hoard it and own it and do it again and again and again. You see, as we saw in Lecture 2 about joy, joy ceases to be joy when it is sought as an end in itself. If he tried to hold on to the pleasure of the gourd, it would cease to be a pleasure. Indeed, the avaricious, lustful desire to own a pleasure, to cling to it even after it has gone sour, is at the core of Satan's evil. We learn that the bent Oyarsa, the evil Oyarsa of earth, we learn that he is holding on to the earth even though it's gone sour. And you know what? Even though he knows it's gone sour, yet he still clings to it. He is avaricious, and he has ceased to enjoy it, and yet he clings. Well, the queen of Paralandra, our Eve character, is innocently free of this desire, the desire for the encore. She receives with joy whatever Mal-El-Dil gives her. She accepts it with thankfulness. Why? Because Eve, or the queen, is above the need for ownership. That is not to say it is a communist, you know, country. The idea is not that private property is bad, but she is above private property. She doesn't need it. It's sort of like a monastery, where a monastery is communism, but it's based on a higher sort of spiritual code. Let's talk a little bit more about the queen. The queen of Paralandra lives in direct communion with Mal-El-Dil. Now, part of that is because of her innocent state. But there's another reason. The other reason is because, Lewis tells us, ever since Mal-El-Dil's son took human form on Folkandra, No intermediaries are needed between human and divine. In other words, ever since Christ took on form, we don't need any intermediaries. The whole universe has changed because of the incarnation. Or as Lewis explains it, within the eschatological framework of his novel, the incarnation of Christ marks a turning point in the universe. Human history since the fall has been one long false start. But on Venus, Ransom glimpses the true state that man was made for. Do you know what we're told in the novel? Ever since the incarnation, from now on, all chna in the universe, all rational creatures, are human. Because Mal-El-Dil chose the human form to incarnate, from now on, there will never be any more Hross or Sorns or Fifeltrigi. Everything is human from now on, because God honored the human form by taking on flesh. And again, it's eschatology. Eschatology means the study of the end, the belief that everything is moving towards a purposeful end. Well, again, for C.S. Lewis, what Christ did on the earth had cosmological repercussions. The whole universe has changed its shape because of what happened on Fulcondra, on the silent planet. The novel ends, Perelandra, with one of Lewis's favorite images, and that is the image of the Great Dance. Remember, in Lecture 5, I told you the Great Dance is part of his image of heaven? Well, let me describe it again. The Great Dance is a hierarchical dance whose center ever shifts because its center is always God. And in this Great Dance, its participants all get their turn at the center only because they remain within the hierarchy. It's a paradox, but all Christianity is paradox. Again, you must lose your life in order to gain it. Only hell, by seeking to be the center, by seeking to be its own ayarsa, is outside the dance. Because it won't give in to the hierarchy, hell is outside the dance. Well, the end of the novel is a festivity as the king and queen of Perelandra are crowned. They have made it through their temptation, as we'll explain in the next lecture. Now, to the festivities come the Oyarsa of Malakandra and the Oyarsa of Perelandra. But they no longer come as controllers of Adam and Eve, if we want to call them that. They come as guests, because now the king and queen no longer need the Oyarsa. They are free. In other words, by submitting, they have finally become their own Oyarsa. Because that's what God wants, but we've got to do it the right way. Again, a paradox. Now, in their exalted state, Ransom recognizes the king and queen as the mythic archetypes of father and mother. But you know what? On Venus, the mythic is also real. What on our earth is merely a myth or an archetype is real and historical and literal on Venus. This is one of the kind of neat aspects of the novel. Even more, when Ransom gazes on the two Oyarsa of Malakandra and Perelandra, do you know what he recognizes? That these two are actually the final mythic historic origin of masculinity and femininity. Remember, men are from Mars, women are from Venus. Well, the Oyarsa, of Mars is the type of masculinity, like the form for Plato, whereas the Oyarsa of Perelandra is the type of the feminine. And behind masculine and feminine are these two forms, these two origins, if you will. Now, modern feminists are going to disagree with Lewis. They're going to say masculinity and femininity are not some platonic form. They are finally social constructs. A simplistic way of putting this is that the only reason boys and girls are different is because we give boys trucks to play with and girls dolls to play with. Now, I have a boy and a girl, and I've met many parents who have both, and everyone I've met thinks this is pretty silly. Boys and girls have a given character. Well, Lewis expands on this by saying that not only are our bodies masculine and feminine, but Lewis believed, and I think the Bible pretty much supports this, that our souls are also masculine and feminine. Or another way to put that is gender is not a societal or linguistic construct, but a reality. It is human language and sexuality that are copies of these origins. In other words, masculinity and femininity do not come out of language and social constructs. It's the other way around. Masculinity and femininity are the original, and our language and our society and even our sexual differences physically are copies of that greater original.